A new novel explores what happens when one person carries out a massive project to geoengineer the climate in secret.
The climate is such a complex system. It is this immensely complicated thing that even the best climate models today only capture like a small percentage of the complexity of how the Earth's system actually works, all of the feedback loops that play into each other. And so we actually have a relatively limited understanding of the full scope of the actual Earth system, and we're just making our best guesses. And so if you start intentionally fiddling with that system, boy, could you have some disastrous side effects.
That's Elliot Pepper. We talk with him about his cli-fi novel, Veil. Then we catch up with author Paul Greenberg about The Climate Diet, 50 Simple Ways to Trim Your Carbon Footprint. It's just out for Earth Day. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. A few years ago, climate fiction, or cli-fi, was a sparsely populated genre. But the growing angst about the climate crisis is finding expression in a plethora of new novels. One of the finest I've read is Veil by my guest Elliot Pepper. It tackles the thorny conundrum we face because of our failure to address climate change on time and to scale. Should we geoengineer the climate to slow the crisis despite unknown risks? And if so, who should decide? This forms the core of Pepper's novel, Veil. In Veil, Pepper gives voice to all sides of the question. Should one tech CEO acting alone be allowed to cool the planet? What if his actions risk millions to starve because the monsoon rains fail, possibly as a result? Should the big global powers, many of which got us into the problem in the first place, make the decision? Or should those small, poor countries like Fiji and other island states be the deciders? All these questions are explored within a plot that unfolds like a spellbinding thriller. Kim Stanley Robinson said of Veil, "This is the best kind of science fiction." In addition to Veil, Elliot Pepper is the author of several other novels, including Borderless, Bandwidth, Cumulus, and The Uncommon series.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So a few years ago, as you say in the afterword to this wonderful novel, Veil, you were listening to a podcast with actually a former Writer's Voice guest, Charles C. Mann, about his book, The Wizard and the Prophet. And the prophet, I believe, is William Voigt, and he is an environmental visionary. Tell us how that podcast led to this book.
Yeah, so when I listened to the podcast with Charles, what really struck me was that the conversation was a really in-depth, long conversation, maybe, I don't know, an hour and a half. And there was this funny sidebar in the middle of it. And The Wizard and the Prophet is about these two 20th century scientists who really shaped what we now think of as environmentalism, which is sort of a way of humans making sense of our relationship to the planet that didn't exist in its current form or sort of its current framing prior to the 20th century. And so Voigt and then Norman Borlaug, they had these opposing interpretations of sort of the role of civilization's relationship with nature in the 20th century. Borlaug, who helped create basically the high yield crops that have helped feed the planet in the 20th century, you know, sort of had this perspective that everything was a problem to be solved, and that we could use technology and science to sort of to solve any problem that came up. And Voigt was this thinker, and he's referred to, you know, of the wizard and the prophet. He's the prophet who sort of warned of the dangers of industrialization and how biodiversity was, you know, being really devastated through human expansion and all of this kind of stuff. And the dialectic between them, that their sort of intellectual argument really shaped 20th century environmentalism. So that, you know, it's a fabulous book. I highly recommend it to anyone. But what inspired me to write Vail was not that discussion. It was a weird rabbit hole that they went into in this podcast interview. And this is why sometimes, you know, when you get off on a tangent, the tangent can be the most fruitful, the most fruitful thing. At least it was for me as a listener. And it was a, you know, 2-minute tangent where Charles was describing this new area of research called geoengineering, which is effectively how it's trying to figure out, are there ways in which we can intentionally engineer the entire planet's climate? So if you think about fossil fuels increasing anthropogenic climate change, that's a way that we unintentionally are re-engineering the Earth's climate. And are there ways to do it on purpose? And it turns out that, you know, there are groups of scientists around the world that are researching exactly this question. And there is one method that that explores in fiction that is called solar geoengineering. And effectively, you know, the sort of simplest version of this would be you fly planes really, really high up in the stratosphere, and you spray very, very fine inert dust in the stratosphere that blocks a tiny percentage of incoming sunlight, cooling the Earth a very, very small amount, and thereby offsetting the increasing temperature thanks to global warming. And so, you know, this is actually, that sounds crazy. And when I was listening to this interview, I was like, oh my God, that sounds crazy. There must be so many potential side effects of this. And like, it sounds so complicated. And yet there's actually more proof that this, at least theoretically, could work than any other approaches to geoengineering, because whenever a big volcano explodes, this happens. So if you imagine a big volcanic explosion, the volcano spews a ton of ash into the really, really high up, into the sky, into the stratosphere. And that ash disperses, and it blocks a little bit of incoming sunlight. And so if you look in the historical record, every time there has been a large volcanic explosion, the Earth's temperature goes down for the next few years. And so this is seen as, you know, basically a proof point that this is at least theoretically possible. And there is more and more research going on in this area. And when I heard Charles describing this real world research, I thought, oh my God, I have to write a novel about this. There are so many sticky questions here, right? Like, not only the sort of obvious things of, does it work? And how could it go wrong, or how could it go right? But also, who gets to decide?
That was one of my questions. So I'm going to stop you there, because that exactly quotes a question that I have. But before we get to it, let's talk a little bit more about the book itself, the novel itself, because you tell this story in such a, I mean, this is a thriller, you know, in this could be in the movies. This was an absolute page turner. So you really get into all these questions through the characters in a really wonderful way. So let's talk about that. The book opens with a heat wave. And actually, the heat wave ends up being the heat wave, capitalized. And a writer, Miranda Leon. So tell us about her and what happens to her.
So Miranda, this character is a journalist. She writes about environmental policy and about actually many of the issues we've been talking about. And she's on a research trip into the forests in northern Colombia, in the Sierra Nevada mountains in northern Colombia. And while she's there, this massive global heat wave strikes and it kills 20 million people around the world. And sadly, this is one of those things that is very likely to happen in the next few decades. And while she's there, because she's in Colombia and in a very rural area that is not very developed, even when she is evacuated from the forest, the village she's evacuated to has no air conditioning and all of the electricity goes out. And so just like in so many other areas of climate impact, those with the least resources are least equipped to survive or to be able to be resilient, right? And so in this, you know, in this scenario, the book actually opens with her dying. And that kicks off the story because her death and the heat wave, of which it is only one small part, you know, she's this one family tragedy among 20 million, really spurs many, many people to much more dramatic action than had been going on before that. And that's really, you know, that sort of ties back in, that's sort of the personal entree to talking about some of these issues, because, you know, when do you go to extreme measures? You go to extreme measures when you are pushed there, when you feel you're in a corner. And it is these kinds of disasters that put people in corners and that lead to these kinds of extreme measures being actually put to use.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Elliot Pepper about Vail, his cli-fi novel about geoengineering the climate. Right. And she leaves behind, you referenced a family tragedy. She leaves behind a mm-hmm. husband, Santiago, and a mm-hmm. daughter, Zia. This is a traumatic event for them. And they both take a very different lesson from it. Talk about Santiago and Zia.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing that I was really trying to figure out when I was writing this book was I was really trying to think about how, you know, the current moment that we're all living through when it comes to our relationship with the environment, there's a lot of loss there. There's a lot of grief. And, you know, when you're writing a novel, you don't, like, I am always looking to try to make those things, to weave those things into a character's personal life, their personal journey. So it isn't just an abstract intellectual discussion of loss, that we actually figure out what loss means to them. And so for, you know, I was really thinking about myself and what me and my family have gone through when we've lost loved ones. And the parallels between that and then losing a piece of yourself, losing a lens through which you see the world and needing to grow beyond it and become someone new on the other side. And for Zia and Santiago in particular, Miranda's death, you know, Santiago's wife and Zia's mother, really set both of their lives. It really changed the direction of both of their lives. So Zia went from pursuing a diplomatic career of wanting to become eventually, you know, an ambassador and really completely shifted and started doing relief work where she was leading teams doing humanitarian aid missions around the world. And Santiago, who leads in the story, he is the CEO, the founder and CEO of a major technology company called Interstice that has these satellites that give you ubiquitous internet access. And so it's actually been interesting because since the novel was published, Elon Musk's SpaceX, his company SpaceX, has announced their Starlink program, which is literally this. They have now satellites that that are starting to do sort of the first step of what Santiago's company does in the novel. But that's also, you know, Miranda's death, his wife's death, spurs him to try to figure out how can he try to take action when it comes to the, you know, climate, when it comes to the fact that, like, his wife's death took climate change as an abstract problem that many people have to grapple with, like, in, you know, in faraway places, to being something that has shattered his life. And so how can he come to grapple with that? And just as his daughter, you know, starts to grapple that by trying to serve and empower those who are suffering the most because of these climate disasters, he goes in the fully, almost an opposing direction, where he thinks about, hey, how can we solve this problem in a more permanent way? How can we use technology to find a point of leverage where we could actually affect millions of lives rather than just the few that we're able to serve in a relief effort? And so, and that's sort of what starts to bring in the geoengineering element.
Right. And she leaves behind, you referenced a family tragedy. She leaves behind a husband, Santiago, and a daughter, Zia. This is a real, obviously a traumatic event for them. And they both take a very different lesson from it. Talk about Santiago and Zia.
Yeah. So Santiago's perspective is something that I think a lot of us can have a lot of sympathy for, in the sense that he decides to try this grand experiment, right? He decides to fly those planes into the stratosphere. He decides to press go. And he is completely jaded by the failure of our political institutions to respond meaningfully to climate change. So he looks at the world and sees a world where, you know, we've known about climate change for decades. Everyone's always talking about it, and nothing seems to improve, right? Like, you know, you have yet another UN meeting, and what comes out the back? Empty promises at best, right? And that there's no mechanism for enforcing, you know, like, any kind of global regulation anyway, because every nation state is sovereign, that every nation state, different countries have different incentives when it comes to how much fossil fuel they want to burn and why. So he looks at sort of the political institutions out there in the world, and he says, this is a mess. You know, climate change has been this problem forever. No one is doing anything meaningful about it. So I'm going to do it myself, right? And I found this lever where I can do it myself. And I know that if anybody finds out what I'm doing, they're not going to let me do it, right? Like, I mean, if one person said, hey, I'm going to start manipulating the global climate, you can bet that every government on Earth would have a problem with that. And not just every government, but probably every person. I mean, it's completely undemocratic. It's being done in a secret way by a single human being, right? And so, but from his perspective, he's like, this is the only way we're actually going to get real change. And so if what we want is real change when it comes to climate, this is the way to actually get it, rather than just have another endless set of diplomatic meetings that lead nowhere. So that's sort of his point of view on why he chose to do this, knowing the risks.
Another point that he's coming from is that he does not see this as a permanent solution.
Yes, thank you. That's a really crucial point. So this kind of a grand experiment is in no way permanent. Not even the strongest advocates for it think of it as a solution to climate change. The only thing it does is it buys time, because when you put a little veil on the outside of the stratosphere, what you're doing is artificially reducing this increase in global temperature. And when you do that, you need to then stop producing more fossil fuel emissions. You need to stop pumping carbon so that then as you reduce your fossil fuel emissions, you can eventually stop flying your planes into the stratosphere again. So it's not a permanent solution. It's simply a stopgap measure that allows you more time to transition the economy away from fossil fuels. And so his perspective is, this is a temporary measure, and I am buying the world time to move away from fossil fuels while reducing and mitigating the worst impacts of rising temperature. So, you know, Zia's perspective is also something that I think many of us can have a lot of sympathy for and really understand, which is that this is a grand experiment. And you don't know experiments are going to work, right? That's what makes them experiment. And so, first of all, like, this might not even work at all. And then second of all, the climate is such a complex system. It is this immensely complicated thing that even the best climate models today only capture like a small percentage of the complexity of how the Earth system actually works, all of the feedback loops that play into each other. And so we actually have a relatively limited understanding of the full scope of the actual Earth system, and we're just making our best guesses. And so if you start intentionally fiddling with that system, boy, could you have some disastrous side effects, right? So that's her sort of first point, is simply that like the level of risk here is staggering, and that you only have the one planet. So you don't get to run a second experiment, right? So like, this is the plan, this is our home. So, you know, that's one element of it. And like one example of a risk that, you know, people talk about a lot when it comes to geoengineering is called the risk of termination shock, which is if you start doing a geoengineering program like this, but you continue to burn fossil fuels without moving your economy in a new direction, and then much later, you stop doing the geoengineering. Well, now you have an atmosphere that's pumped full of carbon and has been artificially kept cool. And so the minute your artificial cooling goes away, you're going to have a very dramatic and dangerous bounce back, where basically you would have this, you know, a very dangerous and fast rise in global temperature that could really destabilize the entire climate. So that's one example of like a theoretical risk that people are already thinking about when it comes to this kind of stuff. But like, there are certainly more, and many more that we haven't even imagined yet. So Zia's first sort of point of contention is that it's just like, there are so many risks associated with doing this. And then the second point of contention is that Zia, through her work as a diplomat, and then later through her work on the ground with climate refugees around the world, sees how little agency most people have over the future all of us are collectively choosing for the planet. And so in this case, Santiago, by running this grand experiment and telling no one about it, has effectively hijacked the climate, right? We're all on the bus, and he has secretly hijacked the bus. He's telling us where to go. No one else even knows where they're going. So we have literally a single human being who is now making his own decisions that are shaping the future of all of us, of all of our children, of all of our grandchildren and our grandchildren's grandchildren. And Zia, who is working every day with the folks who are suffering the most because of climate change, is so extraordinarily aware of the fact that that lack of agency is very related to the problems of climate in the first place, right? Like, as an example, you know, and this was based on doing a lot of reading and getting to know people who do lead humanitarian aid missions for a living. You very quickly see that there, you know, there are no true natural disasters. There are only human disasters that are basically highlighted by nature, right? So if you have an earthquake in a country or in a city rather, that has very good building standards for earthquake safety. Like, I live in Oakland in the San Francisco Bay Area, so we actually have earthquakes all the time. And only rarely are those earthquakes disasters. Usually they're just sort of like, oh, it feels a little weird for a minute and you barely have time to go outside and then it's over, right? And there's no damage. At worst, you have a fallen dish. But if you have an earthquake of the same magnitude in a city, say in Central America, where there is also a lot of earthquakes, but you have much poorer building standards, you know, that same earthquake could knock down many buildings and kill a lot of people and take out your, you know, your electrical, take out your gas, and then that causes fires. So it suddenly becomes a disaster, even though it didn't need to be, like in the sense that if the infrastructure was a little better, then the community could be much more resilient. So Zia sees these realities every day and lives through them. And so she is hyper aware of the fact that her father has effectively turned himself into an environmental dictator. He has hijacked the climate and no one else has a say.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Elliot Pepper about his climate fiction novel, Vail. Another big question is, who is calling the shots? I mean, normally, you know, let's say if countries did decide to do an international geoengineering program, well, it would probably be led by some of the worst fossil fuel petrostates on the planet. The Soviet Union, China, the U.S., you know, they would be the ones calling the shots, whereas the island nations who are being submerged would have nothing to say about it. So I don't want to give the plot away, but talk a little bit about this issue, if you could.
Okay, this, I'm going to have to thread a needle here. So I like this. This is a challenge. Okay, so I actually went to graduate school for international relations, and my focus was on international environmental policy. So I read many treaties and, you know, looked at how the deliberations went and like, why were they formed in those ways? What were the incentives that made these kinds of treaties possible, whereas other ones weren't possible, right? Like those kinds of questions. So I just find that stuff fascinating. And so I think there are a couple of interesting dynamics at work, and I tried to weave those dynamics into the novel and where the novel goes. So one of them is simply that sometimes an effective way to think about international relations is basically, it's a lot like kindergarten, in the sense that it's really hard to get a room full of like energetic kindergartners to agree on anything or to like do anything in an organized way together, because many of them are, you know, someone's hyper, someone's napping, some of them are wrestling with each other or not paying attention, or they just have like completely divergent interests and are trying to do other things at the same time. So it's really hard to wrangle a bunch of kindergartners. And in the same way, it's very hard to wrangle countries to work together. You have many different countries that have different amounts of power, that have different histories, different worldviews. And so getting everyone to really sort of push in the same direction is a huge challenge of human collaboration. And so that's one piece that I really wanted to weave into the novel of how do you get it? It's not impossible. Sometimes you can get the kindergartners to all build something together. It's just rare. So what distinguishes the people who are able to get the kindergartners to build something? What makes those situations possible? So that's one set piece. And then the other was what you just laid out, which is that when it comes to, you know, the geopolitics of climate, you have a number of big things going on. So one of them is that the richest countries in the world, you know, I happen to live in one in the United States, we burned coal, we burned immense amounts of coal. We did all the bad things when it comes to fossil fuel and putting carbon into the atmosphere. We did all of that to get where we are. Our wealth and the level of development we have is in large part based on how we industrialized. And when you look at a country like India, they want to increase their living standards, which how can you argue with that? Like that's a really hard thing to say, well, we did it, but you're not allowed to. So that's one element that's at work in the world today, where you have really wealthy, powerful countries whose wealth was based in carbon-intensive industry, who are now turning around and telling countries that are earlier on in their development, you're not allowed to do the same thing. And that creates a big break. But then there's a second important big break, which is that when you have a lot of these big, powerful countries, including the India, like the developing ones and the more established ones like the United States, they are big, they have diverse economies, they have diverse geographies, they are able to be much more resilient to the impacts of climate change than are poor, impoverished countries or countries that have specific geographies that make them very exposed to the risk of climate change. So, you know, if you're Fiji, you have no say effectively, you know, at the UN. You're too small. You're a little island nation. No one cares. Like you're not going to get a seat at the table when there is a big, important treaty being negotiated. You just don't have enough cards to play. But if you're the kind of country that as sea levels rise, your country will literally disappear. So many of the people and nations who suffer the most because of climate change have the least say in the geopolitics of trying to find solutions for climate change. And so that was something I wanted to grapple with in this novel. And I wanted to pose the question of, is it possible that the countries of the world like Fiji that are most exposed to the risk of climate change and that have the least power over it, is there a way that they could work together in such a way that gives them agency in a way they currently don't have in our international system? And so this novel was in some ways me trying to puzzle that out, to try to think about what might that look like? What could a world look like in which those who were most impacted by this kind of a disaster would actually be empowered to solve it?
You know, we're running out of time, but I had another question, which I really found intriguing. You say in the afterword that writing this novel, Veil, Elliot Pepper, that it changed your life. How did it do that?
You know, it's changed my life in a couple of different ways. One is that as I was writing the novel, so I actually finished drafting the novel as my wife and I were walking the Camino de Santiago, which is a pilgrimage route, an ancient pilgrimage route so we walked 500 miles along the coast of Spain. And I wrote the novel at, you know, sort of like at night in these little weird bunk beds where you're staying in these small rural albergues, these volunteer run guest houses. And it really, finishing the novel while on that literal journey really shaped the story itself and shaped some of the lessons I took from it. So, you know, while we were there, we saw many of the real impacts of climate change. And, you know, living in California here today, we have wildfires now every summer. I mean, last summer, we had to stay inside for weeks at a time, and our air purifiers couldn't keep up with the smoke. And this just really is the problem of our time. We are living at a point in history where we have invented these extraordinary new tools, and those tools give us agency. And so we have all of these new tools at every scale of life. And those tools, like these new technologies, have these this extraordinary power and these extraordinary consequences. And so one thing that, you know, writing this novel really has made me think about deeply is just, it's sort of ironic, but the more technologies we develop and the more powerful technologies that we develop, it actually brings the focus closer on what it means to be human. Because, you know, in the past, like before there was an atom bomb, not even Genghis Khan could have pressed a button that ended the world, right? I mean, Genghis Khan did a lot of nasty stuff, but he was dependent on his generals then ordering their lieutenants, then, or, you know, right? Like just like a human structure and human action to build anything great or to, you know, perpetuate an atrocity. And today, there is a button that can be pressed that could end the world. And just so, there are buttons that can be pressed to do many other things, right? That you can use technology to build wonderful things too. And so what that means is that it comes down to the choices we make, that suddenly the moral choices we make about who we see as part of us and who we define as other, about whether we choose to be selfish because we're afraid of the future, or whether we choose to be generous because we think that we can enlarge the pie. Those are the choices that these technologies bring into ever clearer focus, because these human choices now are magnified. Their consequences are amplified by these very powerful tools. And so that was one big change in my worldview from having written this book, was actually realizing that the things we build, it's sort of like we are living in a strange house of mirrors, where the more things we build, the more power we give ourselves. It means that we need to be that much more thoughtful, that much more empathetic, that much more inclusive in how we approach our lives, both as individuals and also as citizens.
Wow, that is so true, and such a beautiful place to end. This novel, Vale, Elliot Pepper, was most profoundly thought-provoking, and it was also a terrific story to read. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This has been a joy.
Elliot Pepper is the co-creator of the award-winning True Blue website and the game Machine Learning President. He publishes a blog and newsletter documenting his journey as a reader and a writer. Read an excerpt from his novel Vale by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, the climate diet. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Americans need to go on a diet. Not a diet to slim their waistlines, although plenty of us need to do that too, but a climate diet. One that trims CO2 emissions from the atmosphere and gets our companies and governments to do the same. It's all laid out in 50 diet rules in Paul Greenberg's new book, The Climate Diet. Greenberg is an award-winning food and environmental writer, author of such books as Four Fish and The Omega Principle. Paul Greenberg, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
In this book, The Climate Diet, you say that America needs to go on a climate diet. Tell us a little bit, what do you mean by a climate diet?
Well, sad to say, America not only has an obesity problem in its actual diet that of the food it eats, but we also have an obesity problem with the amount of carbon emissions, greenhouse gases, that we emit on a per capita basis. And what I mean by that is, if you look at how much emissions the average American is responsible for, it's around 15, 16 tons. If you look at other countries, it's a much lower. China is less than half of ours on a per capita basis. France is more than or less than a third of ours. India has only 1.5 tons per person. So the UN says that the entire world should be at about 3 tons of emissions per person in order to meet the goals that we are setting so that we don't put ourselves in the red zone vis-a-vis climate. So I guess I'm saying Americans need to get closer to that 3 tons per person. And right now we're at 16. So Americans need to trim their waistline.
Yeah, it sounds like we're pretty morbidly obese.
Yes, from a carbon perspective, for sure. Only in this case, the morbidly part of refers to the planet, or at least the habitable planet for humans. So yes, it's pretty dire.
Yeah. You write that this book came about because you wanted to address an essential disconnect that keeps many Americans on the sidelines of climate action. What's that disconnect, and why does it exist?
Well, so I think that, you know, in the great sweep of environmental activism in this country, there was this period in the 60s and early 70s when people thought, okay, I can do my part, and if I do my part, I can help save the planet. But I think in the language of the last 10 years around the climate, there's been this opposite message, which is that, no, the only way that we're going to fix everything is if we get governments and businesses on board on a major macro scale, and individual action isn't that important. Well, here's the thing. The individual, when confronted that with that message, is pretty much paralyzed, right? Like you hear, oh, no, it's bigger than just the individual. Something has to happen much bigger than myself. And so you say to yourself, well, geez, what's my part in all of this? I think that there is an individual piece to all of this beyond sort of rushing into the streets and holding a placard. So I wanted to, you know, detail, you know, 50 individual actions you could take that I thought would put you in line to start helping the planet.
Yes. Paul Greenberg, in The Climate Diet, you create a bridge between the two approaches of systemic action versus individual action. Tell us more about how you create that bridge.
You know, first of all, we have to think about culture as being a part of politics, right? And the culture of the country needs to shift to a climate-sensitive culture so that, you know, there's an individual action that is just part of who we are going forward. And I think that will inform the politics on a sort of, you know, I don't want to say subconscious level, but let's just say on a cultural level. Over and above that, besides the individual actions that you can take to trim your individual carbon footprint in the first two-thirds of the book, there is a whole other wing of the book that's directed at personal actions that actually prompt businesses and government to take action. So there's a whole section called spending and saving, and there's a whole section called fighting and winning. And what those are, you know, on the saving and spending thing, that's where we can take individual action that sends a signal to corporate America and says, we're not okay with this. And I think if enough people really get involved with this, you know, corporate America tends to listen. I mean, look at how corporate America is responding to the Georgia voting laws, right? Like that's citizen action confronting corporate behavior. And I think the same kind of thing can happen with climate. Now, on the political front, I think that there are ways that we can communicate with politicians, again, on an individual basis, more effectively than just sort of, as I say, you know, running into the street with a placard. There are strategic ways to communicate, and they do focus on individual action.
Yeah, you say, for example, telling a personal story rather than just signing a petition.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of people, unfortunately, in this era of sort of like Twitter activism and so forth, we feel like we've sort of checked our political box if we just simply sign an online petition or something. I spoke with a lot of politicians for this book, and generally they said, you know, those don't really register on their radar. What registers is, you know, getting personal, showing up physically at politicians' offices, either at their, you know, if it's a federal agency sometime, or a federal senator or something like that, they'll often set up mobile offices to hear constituents' remarks. But also, again, you know, not just sort of shouting at a senator, stop climate change, but looking at what the politician in question has purview, has jurisdiction over. So in the case of, say, a council member in a city, a initiative to try and make all public vehicles electric, right? That's a good thing to do. That's something that a council person might have jurisdiction over. But stopping climate change is not something that they can really respond to, if you see what I'm saying.
What I also like about this book, Paul Greenberg, is how you blend both inexpensive, in fact, free ways, in fact, ways that may save you money, with things, you know, you go all the way from kind of the low-hanging fruit to stuff that might take a little bit more thought. For example, you know, LED light bulbs, great things to have. All my light bulbs are LED, but there's more that individuals can do to move the needle on clean power.
Well, yeah. So I spent a lot of time talking to some experts at Natural Resources Defense Council, and they really talked about the importance of what they call smart electrification. And what that means is, starting with the power that's actually going into your home, you actually now have the ability to choose what's called an energy service company, an ESCO, that provides renewable energy electricity into your home. You can choose that. Anyone can do it. In an apartment, in a freestanding house, anyone can do that. So you start with that. You change the electricity source going into your home. And, you know, so that's an easy thing to do. It's not, doesn't really cost you anything. It's pretty much the same price, but you're changing the source of electricity. Then, once you've got smart electricity or renewable energy going into your house, you start to think about your individual appliances. So a really big one is your stovetop. Cooking on gas not only encourages the fossil fuel industry to continue to go after gas, it is also fairly wasteful. About 50% of the energy that should go into your food with a gas stove gets basically lost into the air around you. When you use a smart electric appliance like an induction stove cooktop, about 90% of the energy goes into your food. And if you're, again, if you've got an ESCO that's providing solar or wind to your home, you're basically cooking on the sun or cooking on the wind, which is much better than cooking on gas. So things like that can have a multiplier effect, I think, back to the provider of energy, but also within your home.
I was struck by another one, which is so simple. I mean, I have an electric car, so again, I have solar panels on my roof. But a lot of people cannot afford either an electric car or the solar panels. You have a really simple thing about tire pressure, which you said if everyone did it, it would cut American gasoline consumption by anywhere from 2 to 8%, which is quite a lot.
It is quite a lot. Yeah. I mean, just, and you know, a lot of time air is free, or, you know, a quarter or something like that. And just, you know, it's actually leads to overall better performance of your car. There are a number of things that you can improve in your car, keeping your car tuned up, you know, driving the speed limit, for example, is, you know, and as I'm sure you've seen, I actually tried out an electric car for the last 2 weeks. It is interesting to note that in an electric car, if you go super fast and above the speed limit, you really start burning your battery charge. You don't realize that with gas, but it's true. If you're going above the speed limit, you're burning a lot more gas. And, you know, we all could kind of lay off. You know, also aggressive driving is also really bad, both for your mind and for the environment. When you super accelerate, when you, you know, jam on the accelerator, jam on the brakes, and this is in a conventional car, you're burning a lot of gas. So, you know, trying to fix your behavior is a lot more efficient, or a lot more cost effective than going out and buying a new car.
And food, you know, you've written previous books, The Omega Principle, which we spoke with you about, American Catch for Fish. First of all, tell us about seafood that is lower on the carbon emission scale, and then about other foods that are.
Yeah, no. So I know a lot of people are thinking about seafood right now because of that recent documentary on Netflix called Seaspiracy. But I'm here to tell you that all seafood isn't bad, and some seafood is a very good carbon bargain. In particular, clams, mussels, and oysters are very, very low in carbon. By some producers, by some metrics, actually, a mussel has more nutrients per per gram of emissions than even lentils. So that's pretty striking. Other super good carbon efficient seafoods out there, sardines, anchovies, fish that are caught in what are called midwater trawls that don't drag along the bottom and don't burn fuel that way. Also, Alaskan wild salmon, even though it's coming from far away, generally it's coming to us frozen, and they froze it right there where it's caught. And it's shipped to us at a very low speed, which is also very carbon efficient. So right then and there, if you eat your mussels, eat your anchovies, and eat your Alaska frozen wild salmon, you're in pretty good shape carbon-wise.
That's great. So, Paul Greenberg, let's move on to finances. Yeah. I thought it was pretty, I mean, there is a whole carbon pollution divestment movement. Talk about putting pressure on financial institutions. How does one do that?
Well, I think you start with the point of contact where you're, you know, you can look at your bank, you can look at your, who owns your credit cards or who holds your credit cards. The Rainforest Action Network has a really good report called Banking on Climate Change, which I reference in the book, and that lists the companies that are most deeply involved in underwriting fossil fuels. So look at that, and if you find your bank that is on that list of those top 10, you might give them a call and say, you know what, I'm considering dropping my credit card, dropping my bank account, unless you guys have a clear and, you know, visible direction to get out of underwriting fossil fuels. So I think that's one way to do it. I think you can also start looking at, you know, credit unions, and there are some banks out there that have made a committed commitment to not being involved in fossil fuels. There are insurance companies, one called Lemonade, that is committed to not insuring fossil fuel companies because, of course, as Bill McKibben points out, you can't really have fossil fuel exploration without insurance. So staying away from those businesses that expand fossil fuels' reach, whereas we want to shrink it, is a good thing for the individual to do.
And then investments. You point out that the Global Clean Energy Index 3-year return was over 14% compared to just 9% for the general S&P. That's a real turnaround.
It is a real turnaround. And I mean, it's very exciting. It might be one of the most exciting. And again, I have to credit McKibben for pointing this out. But, you know, the price of wind and solar is really dropping. You know, the technology is super exciting. I think as we're starting to see, you know, we're seeing a real both market and personal backlash against tech, you know, and for years, computer technology was something that really drove, I think, a lot of the investment cycle. But I kind of think that green investment is finally going to have its moment. And I think, you know, if you want to be involved with the next Apple and the next Amazon, it's probably going to come out of the green technology sector. So, you know, buckle your seatbelts. You could lose some money, but you know, even with a conservative investment strategy, I think the upsides are really there.
I can personally attest to that. I have only invested in clean energy. And the first, you know, I'd say the first 20 years, it just bumped along basically barely besting inflation, and it's skyrocketed in the last 2 years.
That's right. Yeah, I too have dipped my toe in, and I've seen, for example, just a basket of a mutual fund called ticker symbol TAN that invests in solar stuff, just, you know, incredibly high. It's sort of funny because I can't remember. I don't think you and I spoke about it, but I wrote another book called Goodbye Phone, Hello World. And it was all about giving up your phone, and so which I did. And I used the money that I normally spent on my phone, you know, that $80 a month, I used to make sort of investments in the future. So at first I bought marijuana stocks and they tanked. They didn't do so well. But then I started putting it into solar, and actually that solar mutual fund more than tripled in value and more than erased my marijuana losses. So overall, I did well, and I think I will continue in that direction.
And that's really doing well by doing good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, who knows? Hopefully my marijuana stocks will revive soon. I did see that New York State legalized recently, so who knows?
That's true. You know, in the few minutes we have left, I'd like to ask you about an op-ed that you did for the New York Times with Carl Safina. It published on April 13th. We don't need more life-crushing steel and concrete. You're talking about the infrastructure plans. Just briefly, give us a sense of what you and Carl Safina, who's also been a guest on this show, are talking about in that article.
Well, I think that we both are very sensitive to the fragility of the natural world, and we're both very sensitive to the degree to which we have interrupted the infrastructure of nature by throwing a lot of steel and concrete in its path and fragmenting the natural world. We have before us, you know, this $2 trillion opportunity to remake the infrastructure of America. But I think, you know, the knee-jerk thing to do is just to build more stuff. But I think Carl's and my point of view is that we actually need to focus on rebuilding a lot of stuff. Like if you look at, for example, all the dead malls there are over all over the United States, you know, partially caused by COVID, but also because of the rise of online retail. Why aren't those being considered as places for solar fields? Why am I seeing forests cut down and replaced by solar panels? Makes absolutely no sense. Why is there talk about building a whole charging, electric charging infrastructure when actually we could decommission a bunch of gas stations, make those electric, and try to position those near commuting hubs so that there could be more park and charge and ride, that kind of thing. You know, everyone's gung-ho to build giant windmills everywhere, and certainly wind power is going to have a part of that story. But the first thing we should do is retrofit, and then the second thing is start to think about, you know, when necessary, when we have to build new stuff.
I couldn't agree more. And Paul Greenberg, this book, The Climate Diet, is perfect reading for Earth Day and beyond. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Greenberg. Go to writersvoice.net to read his op-ed, co-written with Carl Safina for the New York Times. We post the show to the podcast and website on Thursdays. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with best-selling novelist Lisa Scottolini about her first historical novel, Eternal. And Julia Fine tells us about The Upstairs House, a genre-bending novel about new motherhood. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.